Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to the glory of God and his kingdom. We're going to be talking a bit about enemies, foreign and domestic, as we often do on this program. Rarely better than when we have in-house, at least virtually, our first and only guest for today. Charles Sam Faddis is his name. He has had others, particularly when he has been working undercover as a clandestine service officer of the Central Intelligence Agency in the course of a very long and distinguished career of, well, recruiting and running foreign agents for our country, often in some pretty unsavory places around the world, and always at great peril to himself and to, I think, the benefit of every American. We're always grateful to have the chance to visit with him. In addition to working for the agency, as it's called, he also served in uniform in the United States Army. He was an assistant attorney general out in Washington State. He has been a candidate for Congress. He has been a prime mover behind efforts to assure election integrity nationwide, but particularly in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, where he resides. And hardly least, he is a fabulous essayist at andmagazine.com at Substack. We're always thrilled to have a chance to visit with him, but never more so than when we can do so at length. And he's giving us a full hour of his time today, for which we are really grateful. Sam, welcome back to Securing America. It's a treat to have you with us. Merry Christmas and the best for the new year.
Thank you for having me as always, and Merry Christmas to you, Frank.
Thank you. Let me start by picking up on the subject of a conversation we had recently, Sam, that I have been, well, endlessly amplifying to the extent I can, because I think it was one of the most important sound bites in my memory. And that was in the course of our conversation about how you, as a longtime intelligence professional, knowing intimately the tradecraft of espionage, and also the lexicon that those in the business use, I asked you to describe how the Chinese Communist Party would view Joe Biden, now the President of the United States, our chief executive, our commander-in-chief. Remind us what you said.
Well, I mean, as a foundational statement, I guess, remind everybody what you just said, which is, I spent a large portion of my life in the business of espionage, not just watching espionage, analyzing espionage, but conducting espionage, recruiting sources inside Al-Qaeda, Russian intelligence, Iranian nuclear program. That was my business for a very long time. Everything about the Biden case, if that's a way to describe it, reeks of Chinese espionage. It is, take the template, take everything we know about how they operate, and take a look at every fact we are aware of concerning not just Hunter, but Joe Biden, the guy sitting in the Oval Office. And it screams that this is a textbook case of recruiting someone to work for a hostile intelligence service. And that is precisely the term that a case officer, an intelligence officer, a person who runs ops would use. Not about co-opting a little bit, not about hoping you can change their worldview, right? That's the business of diplomats. And it's not about really blackmailing them later. It is about a transactional thing where when you're all done, the guy, the source, works for you. He is controlled by you. Again, that is that's straight out of spy lexicon. That's the terminology that would be used. And everything we know about what transpired between the CCP, Joe Biden, Hunter Biden says, this guy, Joe, sitting in the Oval Office, is very likely to be a controlled asset. Again, that's the precise terminology CIA would use. of our number one enemy on the planet. Now, I would add this, you know, we're now seeing all this splash and coverage of Twitter and the FBI and them covering up Hunter Biden's laptop. So let's, you know, let's put the exclamation mark on this. The FBI knows everything I just said, right? They know how Chinese intel works. They know their number one target is American policymakers. They had access to all the information on Hunter Biden's laptop long before other folks saw it. Meaning when the FBI was making decisions about covering up Hunter's laptop and convincing people to ignore it, they weren't just impacting a presidential election, which of course is horrifying enough. They were actively intervening into what gave every indication of being the most damaging foreign espionage case we have ever experienced as a republic, and actively working to prevent it from being investigated and explored, and the Americans know it. I mean, if you take that to its logical conclusion, they were running cover for Chinese intelligence, which is inexplicable, but that's where that takes you.
Again, this conversation, even though we had a variation on the theme a little while ago, still makes my head explode. Sam, when you talk about what the FBI did here, just for calibration purposes, remind us of one of the most important, arguably the single most important function of the Federal Bureau of Investigation when it comes specifically to espionage.
Yeah, well, I think that's that takes us to the heart of the matter. I think it's a superb question, right? The context here is the FBI is the number one counterintelligence entity in the U.S. intelligence structure. One of its core missions is counterintelligence. And take 3 minutes and go on Google, even with their algorithms, and you will see that in the FBI tells you the number one counterintelligence threat to the United States is Chinese intelligence. Straight up, black and white, on their website. So there is no ambiguity about this. It's not a theory. It's not a, hey, this might be a concern. That is bedrock. The Chinese are the number one counterintelligence threat. And again, read in the FBI's own verbiage right on their website. And what are the premier targets of Chinese intelligence? American policymakers and the elite. This is known. So this is the context. And basically that everything I've said about, you know, my professional background and what this looks like to me, the FBI knows all of that. Not like Sam Faddis has a lock on that understanding of how their tradecraft work. The FBI knows that. Here's our number one enemy. They're our number one counterintelligence threat. Here's the template for how they work. Everything about the Biden case says, good God, these people may have recruited Joe Biden. And in that context, they not only didn't investigate it, they actively worked to bury it and cover it up. And let's, you know, another exclamation mark, I guess, it's 3 years later, and they're still not investigating it. They are ignoring this.
Sam, we have to take a short break. When we come back, I want to ask you, is the possible explanation here that they just put Hunter Biden's hard drive in a drawer and never looked into it, and therefore were not prompted to investigate, let alone take corrective action like warning the rest of us that we were about to elect a guy who is a controlled asset of the Chinese Communist Party? We'll talk about that and more with Sam Faddis right after this.
The
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute, in a classic example of why the American people distrust, if not actually loathe, their so-called representatives in Washington. A Congress that no longer has a mandate to represent anybody is about to foist upon its successor and the rest of us a monster. The bipartisan congressional leadership called this 4,000-page, nearly $2 trillion legislation the omnibus. It's actually the omnivorous. For its unsustainable spending, its radical leftist policies and other mandates will consume everything in sight. Our national creditworthiness, the dollar's reserve status, 2020 voters' preferences, and our surviving constitutional freedoms. The collusion of the political establishment's radical leftist Democrats and controlled opposition Republicans have brought us this disaster. Those who actually represent us must use every tactic possible to ensure there's no long-term spending bill until after a new Congress is seated in 13 days. This is Frank Gaffney. Sam Faddis is with us virtually. We're always pleased to catch up with him for however long and wherever he may be. Sore throat or otherwise, he seems to be in peak form today, I'm happy to report, and with us for a full hour, which is just an incredible blessing. Sam, I put the question to you before the block ended, and I put it to you again. Given that the premier counterintelligence agency of the United States government did nothing, certainly nothing helpful, nothing to stop what you have, I think, quite properly described as the most deadly or dangerous foreign espionage case in the nation's history, that maybe they just missed the cue. Maybe they didn't actually look at that hard drive, it sat in a drawer unnoticed, and nature just took its course. Is that a possible explanation for what would seem to otherwise be the most egregious example of malfeasance I can think of?
Well, you know, I'm a big believer that with so many of the problems that you and I discussed, that we see a mixture of malfeasance and then incompetence, neglect, whatever. So I am sure that it is possible that within the Federal Bureau of Investigation, there are individuals and have been individuals who basically look at this and say, I don't want to go within 50 miles of this radioactive case involving presidential politics. I'm 5 years from my pension and buying my bass boat, and I don't need this. So that kind of human nature element, I'm sure, is at play. But I don't think you can possibly just ascribe all of this to that motivation. It's not just that they didn't investigate it. It's they actively then worked overtime to bury it, intervene, took action just involving Twitter, which is clearly unconstitutional to suppress free speech on this.
And as you say, so, Twitter is just the one that we have the smoking gun on. It's almost certainly true of the other major social media platforms too, no?
Without question, that's an excellent point, right? We now are talking about Twitter because Elon bought the company and therefore we have visibility. But everything that we see with Twitter, yes, there's every reason to assume that it was done with every other major social media platform. They actively intervened to suppress this.
Okay, so that suggests that they certainly knew that this was radioactive, and therefore, I think, rebuts the benefit of the doubt scenario. But as you say, Sam, what we now know from these internal files is that this was not just a one-off, hey, look over there, folks, instead of here. This was a coordinated, sustained, and evidently ongoing effort to tamp down interest in or understanding of the greatest counterintelligence crisis in our country's history. It's mind-boggling.
Yeah, and look, for the average person, all of this probably sounds like science fiction, like the idea that espionage goes on this scale and can really have this kind of impact. And because they don't have any visibility into it, and there's no reason they should. It is not science fiction. And we have experienced in the past massive world-altering impacts from espionage. The Manhattan Project, right, which you and I have discussed before. We built and developed the atomic bomb. A few years later, the Russians fired off one of their own. Not because they duplicated our Manhattan Project, because they stole everything down to the engineering blueprints for the construction of the American atomic bomb. Their first, if Los Alamos outsourced the construction of a bomb to the Russians in 1949, it would have been the bomb the Russians detonated, because literally the size of the bolts, the placement of the bolt, it was the American Fat Man device. Changed the entire balance of power. We're dealing with the repercussions generations later from a communist espionage operation into that program. And yet what we're talking about right now, if the worst is true, makes that pale in comparison. And, you know, I would submit to anybody, okay, sit down and make a list of every national security decision Joe Biden has made since he sat down in the Oval Office, and identify to me where he has at any point deviated from what Xi Jinping would want him to have done. Point by point by point. At every decision point, where has Joe Biden ever taken an action to the detriment of the Chinese Communist Party? I defy you to find a single example.
Well, let me take you up on this, Sam, because one example that I'm sure Biden's defenders would point to is this decision to cut off their access to some of our chip technology that has apparently, you know, caused quite a kerfuffle within the Chinese industrial base. Is that not an example of something that Xi would certainly not have wanted him to do and that he nonetheless did?
Well, I have seen announcements and heard verbiage from the White House. I have yet to see meaningful, concrete, lasting action that actually strategically changes anything. And just to introduce another element here, as having run assets inside foreign governments where there was a possibility of suspicion that they worked for the Americans, it is a common technique to advise your asset that periodically he needs to make some noise that suggests he's not a lackey of the Americans, because otherwise suspicion falls upon him. So sort of blowing smoke and making noise and doesn't really end the inquiry. To me, it's okay, let's just stop focusing on that. Let's look at the real, lasting, concrete strategic decisions. I haven't seen those yet.
Well, and I would offer as a possible explanation for why even that chip decision might have been in the service of Xi, is it's been compared to FDR's decision to cut off oil and I think steel, rubber, the Japanese were extracting from the Dutch East Indies, which conduced to the Japanese deciding they had to go for it in World War II. We are certainly watching Xi positioning for, if not actively preparing to begin, the attack on Taiwan, which has all of the chips that he wants and more. Maybe this is the casus belli that if he needed one, he would want, provided by a controlled asset called Joe Biden. Sam, I think this is so important. And the thing that I particularly value about your clarity on this point is, as the consummate national security professional, you have an appreciation of the damage that can be done if the man who is in this particular position in the Oval Office, Commander-in-Chief, Chief Executive, the President of the United States, could do. And in a way, I guess, outlined it with the reference to everything that she wants him to do. But just in 30 seconds, characterize a damage assessment.
Catastrophic? Catastrophic's not even a strong enough word. I don't know. Existential? The word gets overused, but if it was ever appropriate, this is it. How can you survive if your commander in chief is working for the enemy? You cannot. Everything else is irrelevant.
Especially if that enemy is emboldened to go to war with you, and then you find yourselves deeply compromised in fighting that war against them. We're going to come back with more with the Great Sam Faddis on the other side of a very short break. Stay tuned.
And throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa, Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. We are continuing this hour-long, very special edition of Securing America with one of our regulars, one of our favorite guests, for that matter, Sam Faddis, former CIA undercover operative, a man who has continued to serve his country long after, well, both taking off his army uniform and shedding the undercover garb of an agency asset and spy. We're now talking with a man who continues to, as I say, help us all understand the fix we're in at the moment through a marvelous column and product called andmagazine.com, which you can find at Substack these days. Sam, you wrote recently at Substack about a part of the world in which you did some of that undercover derring do, specifically pallets of cash that have been turning up in the Taliban's hands. They've actually boasted of it. What can you tell us about where that cash is coming from and how this really adds insult to the injury that we experienced thanks to Joe Biden and his team a year ago when they surrendered the place to those folks?
Yeah, well, you know, the Biden administration periodically announces that we've gone into Syria and killed some ISIS leader, and God bless them. The guys carrying out those operations are the best we have, and the world will not miss these ISIS leaders. That is a positive thing. While we're worried about this rump state of this rump caliphate in Syria and these little pockets, We're not supposed to pay any attention to the fact that we have a new terrorist superstate, the Emirate, in Afghanistan, with the Taliban and then every horrible terrorist group on the planet basically has set up shop there. To make it worse, the Biden administration has now decided that they're going to send massive quantities of what they classify as humanitarian aid to the Taliban. So we are sending, but they have made that very clear. Now, in parallel with that, now the Taliban is basically bragging and showcasing that these pallets of crisp $100 bills are showing up, you know, still banded from the treasury and shrink wrapped and everything, and being turned over to them. Now, they're being a little coy about who it's coming from, but there's no question about who it's coming from. This is the money that Joe told us he's going to send them, literally billions of dollars, on the fantasy that the Taliban, the number one heroin dealers on the planet, the guys who just banned women from higher education, who are busy flogging and stoning people, that they're going to use this
and killing them outright.
And killing them outright, and that these barbarians are going to actually, that the money is going to be used for good purposes. So we're not only not stopping the Taliban from expanding its control. By the way, they're long since, along with their brothers in Pakistan, now waging war against Islamabad, because that's Pakistan is the next country they want to fall and be incorporated into the Emirate. While they're doing this, we're sending cash to these guys. We're not only not killing them or inhibiting them, we're basically giving them the cash for the next 9/11. That's what's happening, and we're pretending like we're not doing it.
And among the litany of horribles that you skipped over is the $85 billion worth of advanced weaponry we also gave them for the purposes of presumably terrorist, among other operations, some of which we have reason to believe has been migrating to other enemies of ours, presumably among their terrorist cadre, but also state adversaries like, well, Russia and China, probably. Which brings us back to your earlier point. Isn't it the case, Sam, that Joe Biden's surrender of Afghanistan has been a huge strategic benefit to Xi Jinping in a number of different respects? Yeah, well,
without question. The Chinese are all over Afghanistan now. The Chinese control Bagram Air Base. We pretend, you know, a massive facility the Russians built, and then we dramatically expanded in a very strategic location to alter the balance of power in South Asia, now available to and the Chinese, and the Chinese have personnel on the ground there. Again, we're pretending like that's not happening. You made reference to weapons, okay? It is a documented fact that the Pakistani Taliban, which is in league with the Taliban in Afghanistan, is in possession of night vision goggles, all sorts of weaponry. All of this is American stuff from Afghanistan surrendered to the Taliban, already on the battlefield, being used to kill Pakistani security forces and they have outright declared their intention, both Talibans, if you will, to raise the white flag, in other words, to raise the flag of the Emirate over Islamabad. This is not, we don't have to wonder whether that will happen. It is happening right now. And you made reference to $85 billion in weaponry. Think about it also this way. It's not just we left it, but every day since, we have made a conscious decision to leave them in possession of it. If you got a motor pool filled with MRAP vehicles or helicopters, Tomahawk missiles with no risk to American lives from thousands of miles away can eliminate all of that capacity with the press of a button, literally. The President of the United States can deprive them of all the helicopters, aircraft, vehicles they have. Every day he sits in the Oval Office, Biden makes a conscious decision. No, I'll let him have it. I'll let him use it. And you could see, by the way, that they are rapidly putting aircraft back in service.
Right. And some of them are out of those depots, of course, by now. But the point is very well taken. And Sam, just to put a fine point on it, each time we talk about Pakistan, a country you know well, I feel constrained to say, should the white flag of jihad, the emirate, the caliphate, fly over Islamabad, to some extent, the successors to Zia al-Huq, the, original Islamist leader of Pakistan, put it on this course already. But should that happen, should the Taliban come to power, one of the other things, presumably, that they would have access to is not just this cache of sophisticated American conventional weapons, but Pakistani nuclear weapons as well, don't you think?
Yeah, you're talking, the exact number is classified, but you're talking somewhere in the neighborhood of 200 fully functional nuclear warheads and all the delivery vehicles for them. So surface-to-surface missiles. So you are talking about the Islamic Emirate in Afghanistan becoming a nuclear power. By the way, obviously their ambitions do not end with Pakistan. They have already very explicitly threatened India. The repercussions of this, the ramifications, the ripple effect are massive. This is a threat to the security of the entire planet, and we're pretending like it's not happening.
Or that it's not our problem if it is happening, and far from it. And again, just back to your opening point, if we're pouring more money into the hands of the perpetrators of all of this, the aspirants to those knock-on effects especially, we're enabling it. Far from challenging it or preventing it, we are making it that much more likely. I just have to say one other piece of this Afghan legacy that came up in a webinar that we did the other day for our Committee on the Present Danger China, of which I'm very proud you are a member, Sam Pattis, was the interview that our chairman, Brian Kennedy, and I did with Garrett Ziegler, a man who had served in the White House under President Trump, working for Peter Navarro, and has done a deep dive in the Marco Polo USA website, among other outlets, into this laptop of Hunter Biden's. And one of the things that he mentioned in the course of our interview was that it was evidence there, and probably elsewhere as well, that Hunter Biden's investment in BHR, as I recall is the name of the company, which he says has something to do with lithium extraction, is ongoing. This investment, this relationship with this Chinese company is ongoing, and therefore, to the extent that the Chinese are using it, among others, perhaps to extract lithium from deposits in Afghanistan, it's not only enhancing China's role as the purveyor of lithium for batteries and all of the other stuff that makes the Green New Deal a formula for our greater dependency on China, but it's a profit vehicle for the Biden family. Have you tracked that, and does that surprise you? And if not, either way, no, what do you make of it?
It doesn't surprise me at all. We went through the phases of we're not going to talk about Hunter's laptop, but now I guess we can kind of talk about Hunter's laptop. In the sense of the so-called mainstream media. But now it's Hunter's got a coke habit, and Hunter has a fondness for hookers, and Hunter's kind of a sleaze bag. And they keep finding new ways to ignore the real issues here, right? Is the guy sitting in the Oval Office an asset of the Chinese intelligence? What were the Chinese buying for all of this money, right? What was flowing back the other way? What are the strategic implications? And now look at our policies. You talk about lithium. I wrote an article a number of months ago saying, basically, if you really liked being dependent upon Arab oil, you're going to love being dependent upon rare earth minerals from China, because the whole Green New Deal is predicated on we now are owned by Chinese when it comes to rare earth minerals.
And if it weren't bad enough that we have all of these other supply chain dependencies for medicine and flat screens and so much more, this one is being intensified by American policy. Sam, one more break we have to take. We'll be right back with more with Sam Faddis right after this. Thanks for tuning in to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney. If you find the content of this program to be informative and valuable, I'd like to ask you to consider playing a part in supporting the organization that makes Securing America possible, our Center for Security Policy. We call the center the home of the special forces in the War of Ideas. We feature such warriors daily on Securing America as they diagnose the dangers facing our nation, develop strategies for thwarting them, and work with other veteran national security practitioners, legislators, and the American people to execute those strategies. Thanks to our friends at the American Family Network, we're able to expand greatly awareness of the Center for Security Policy's efforts and their impact. Like the real special forces, our effectiveness depends on having the ammunition, in our case money, to perform our mission. Please consider making a tax-deductible contribution at securefreedom.org. Thanks. We're back, and we're going to continue our conversation with Sam Faddis, a longtime intelligence operative, but in his post-government service, he has thrown himself in, as one would hope any good patriot does, into the business of trying to assure the integrity of our elections. And sadly, both in his own home state of Pennsylvania and elsewhere across the country, there are a lot of serious questions being raised about the free and fair elections that we'd been promised not having been delivered either in 2020 or in the most recent midterm elections. And Sam, I know you worked tirelessly to try to get the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania to fix some of the problems that were identified in that last presidential election. Remind us of what happened to those efforts and give us an update on what specifically transpired as you saw it firsthand on the ground in Pennsylvania in the midterm elections.
Well, the short version is that Pennsylvania, like so many states, went down the road of moving to mail-in ballots and drop boxes back in 2019. I should add that that was a Republican-controlled legislature that in their infinite wisdom decided to take us down that road. And then, like all the other states that have walked that road, it's been a disaster ever since. I mean, you know, painting with a very broad brush, we spent 200 or 300 years in this country putting in place measures to ensure the integrity of the ballot box. Show up at the ballot box, walk behind a curtain, vote anonymously, no electioneering in the polling place, all designed to let you vote your conscience without influence and without outside control.
And ideally and with some sort of identification that you are, in fact,
some sort of identification and nobody gets to know how you voted and we can't hold a gun to your head or pay you for your vote, or et cetera. And now we just decided to scrap all of that and open the Pandora's box to an almost endless list of ways to manipulate system. What happened? The Pennsylvania state legislature after 2020, despite all the pressure, decided to do nothing of any consequence to fix any problems.
You skipped over one step. Did in the 2020 race, in your estimation, the decisions that the state legislature took, and as I recall, the state Supreme Court as well had a hand in all of this, and the governor too. But did all of that translate into an election that was not, in fact, free and fair in 2020 in the Commonwealth?
Look, without question, and again, this is not something, you know, I didn't hear this from Bigfoot yesterday. Just look at the actual facts here. That in the Pennsylvania state election in 2020 in Pennsylvania, in the presidential election, an investigation after there found that there were over 200,000 more votes than registered voters who voted in the election. Now, as I always say, I'm not a math whiz, but I'm pretty sure if you only get to vote once, those two numbers have to be the same. If you got 200,000 votes, over 200,000 votes, that you can't connect to a registered voter, you got a problem. You have an obvious problem. You have, at a minimum, your systems are horribly broken if you can't even count that. We haven't fixed any of that in the state of Pennsylvania. I tell you how, and the Supreme Court, yes, jumped in. Drop boxes were not enacted by the state legislature. The Supreme Court, which is a Democratic partisan entity, in its infinite wisdom, issued a ruling winking them into existence, making itself some sort of super legislature. So nobody even voted for that. Again, nobody's fixed any of this. I'll tell you how bad
it is. And when it was drop boxes, it was drop boxes that were not under sort of surveillance or control and were, again, all of this. And the thing that just is mind-boggling again, Sam, is going back to, I think it was 2002, if I'm not mistaken, Jimmy Carter, former Democratic president of the United States, and Jim Baker, former Republican everything, Secretary of State, Secretary of Treasury, Chief of Staff of the White House, formally presented findings of a commission that they ran that said, on a bipartisan basis, don't go anywhere near these yes. mail-in ballots. Yes. They are a formula for fraud. So it's not as though we haven't been put on notice that this is a very bad idea, right?
100% bipartisan. You know, Jimmy Carter, that Jimmy Carter, the former president of the United States, signed off on a report, and there's a lengthy section in that report. It's a little hard to find online now because Google tries to prevent you from finding it. But there's a really lengthy section that says straight up, if you want to steal elections, you want mail-in voting. And in fact, told the states that had already moved to mail-in voting, like Oregon by that time, I think it was 2005, said you need to go back the other way because you're destroying the electoral process. This is how bad it is in Pennsylvania. This is happening right now. At the county level, at least, we have Republican officials who are now re-registering as Democrats to run for re-election the next primary. They are making conscious decisions. I can never win as a Republican again. So even though they're in office and they are Republican office holders, they are re-registering to run as Democrats because they have accepted that the Democratic Party has now so rigged the system that a Republican has no chance of getting one. That's
well, presumably right, Republicans would not be inclined to vote for them either. I guess that might be another consideration. Sam, I think in the intelligence business, we talked about the lexicon of intelligence. This would be called a clue that you have a problem, right? So, Sam Fettes, you've been working on this, obviously, in the state of Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Carrie Lake, as we speak, is bringing forward hard evidence in court at last that in Arizona, similar kinds of mischief was made and resulted in a miscarriage there in the election for governor that she stood for against, by the way, the Secretary of State, who is overseeing this exercise. Just 30 seconds on that, if you could quickly.
Well, good for her. I think what she's doing is she's fighting and she's producing the facts, which you have to produce. And as soon as you start producing the facts, you realize this is not, again, a conspiracy theory. I mean, in this case, they made the ballots deliberately too small for the machines to scan them in order to introduce an element where they could play with the system.
Sam, very succinctly said, and I hope Carrie Lake prevails. Good on the judge for hearing her case, and I hope that he will realize that it has merit and has to be remedied now. Sam Fettes is going to stay with us for one more break. We'll be right back with more right after this. We're back, and we're visiting in a very free-range conversation with a dear friend and valued colleague, Sam Fettes, longtime intelligence, and more generally, national security professional who brings the hard-won experience of many years in the service to our country, to what he does these days, which is a wonderful column called nmagazine.com at Substack. I encourage you to check it out, to subscribe, to take it aboard as I do practically daily. Sam, I wanted to turn to one other aspect of the problem. I would call it the enemy within problem. You spoke of what Republicans in the state legislature in Pennsylvania have been doing to undermine our elections. It seems as though Republicans in the federal legislature, the now outgoing, I think it's 117th Congress, are up to in the form of something called the Omnibus Bill. And I've done a commentary for today in which I say it's kind of a sleight of hand of the monoparty or uniparty, if you will, of Washington, the establishment, the hard left and the controlled Republican opposition, to ascribe to it a name that doesn't mean anything to most Americans. I think rather than omnibus, it should be considered the omnivorous, because everything we care about is going to be consumed by the cumulative effects of this and what's preceded it. A 4,000-page bill, $1.7 trillion more in spending, destroying, I think, further confidence in our dollar and imposing all kinds of radical left policies, including in the election context. Have you had a chance to look at this at all? And either way, what are we to make of the fact that Republicans are party to foisting this on us with 13 days to go before a new Congress, duly elected with a new majority, comes to power?
Well, Frank, you know, I think whatever issues we're talking about, whether we're talking about this bill or whether we're talking about elections like we were just discussing, the central issue here is you have we are face to face, obviously, with a very aggressive leftist agenda, with Marxist, a Marxist agenda. And what we don't have is we don't actually have an opposition fighting that. When I look at it from the standpoint of the Republican Party, and we'll talk about Pennsylvania, wherever, you have a base of the party, which I think really represents the vast majority of Americans, with a certain set of viewpoints, which are basically America First, MAGA type viewpoints. Let's take Donald Trump out of it. Take the personality out of it. On policy issues, that's where the bulk of the American people are. We don't have
even people who would vote Democrat.
Yes, I mean, drive around small towns in Pennsylvania, past the closed mills, and everybody has to shop at the dollar store now. And those folks agree on, you know, this is wrong. We ought to be putting America first. We don't have a GOP establishment fighting for those issues. They mouth platitudes. They talk out of both sides of their mouth in classic political fashion. But they will not stand up and fight for the American people. So, yeah, on this bill, this is an atrocity. Good Lord, the inflation implications, the priorities, the money we're sending, you know, to Ukraine, but we won't close our own border. On down the list, it's an atrocity. We you know, back we were talking earlier about Pennsylvania. This is the issue at the state level as well. It's the issue all throughout the country. We do in fact have a uniparty in that sense, and they are not working in the interests of the American people. And the central fight here is that's got to change. Those folks have to be replaced by people who actually represent the American people. That's what.
Which brings us back to what we were discussing a moment ago, the need for elections that actually reflect the majority will of those entitled to vote. And the farther we get away from the fundamentals of those, the tabulating machines in Arizona, for example, or the ballot boxes being stuffed with mail-in ballots, universally mailed in some states to everybody and then some, you know, the further we get away from having that as a potential corrective. So, Sam, we've got about 2 minutes. Walk through what your counsel would be to our audience, to those who are hopefully listening to their desires because they're supposed to represent us, both in this Congress and certainly in the new one. What is your counsel, sir, in terms of this particular set of problems and how we fix it?
Well, here's the bottom line. Nobody's coming to save us. We're going to save ourselves. There isn't going to be a magic court case or a guy on a white horse who rides in and fixes this. It's going to take a lot of work, a lot of blood, sweat, and tears, and it has to start at the local level. So stop looking for a silver bullet. This starts at the school board level, the county, the commissioner level, the county council, depending on what state you're in, and everybody getting involved and making the change. And it really, I can tell you where we are with in Pennsylvania with the Patriot groups. We are past the point of going to the state legislature and asking state senators to do the right thing, because we have asked and they have refused. So now the entire game is replacing those state senators and replacing those state representatives with people who will fight. Easy? No. I mean, easy to say, simple to a massive undertaking. But can it be done,
Sam, as long as those interested parties are making the rules for the elections by which they will be turned out?
If I believed otherwise, obviously, I'd probably be sitting on a Greek island somewhere to enjoying my retirement years. But no, can it be done? 100%. Will it be easy? Will it be effortless victory? Will we snap our fingers? By no means. But as I said, speaking the other day, look, everybody grew up on these stories of the revolution, sunshine patriots hanging in there. Well, welcome to the party, folks, to steal a quote from Die Hard. Now you get a taste of what it's like to actually just have to slog your way through. That's what it takes to preserve democracy.
We're not talking about violence, needless to say, but we are talking about engaging in the fight, in a manner of speaking.
Absolutely.
Sam Faddis, you are one of our leaders in all of that. Thank you for being so valiant in 2022. We look forward to visiting with you often in 2023. In the meantime, Merry Christmas and a very, very prosperous new year. Same to the rest of you. We'll talk with you again tomorrow. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Go forth and multiply.